Welcome to the Risk and Repeat podcast, episode number 108. I'm Rob Wright, editor of Cert Security, and I am here in our podcast studio, aka Chernobyl, with my site editor, Peter Loschen. Peter, welcome.
Hi, Rob.
Peter.
Rob.
We have we've spilled a considerable amount of ink, both public and probably private, on our Slack channel.
Virtual ink.
Yeah. On our topic
yes.
of today, topic for this episode, which we should say, I should say, we are recording today, Friday, May 18th. It has been a week of eFail. eFail being the vulnerabilities that were not so smoothly announced about PGP and S/MIME protocols for email encryption, widely used. And there were some researchers that discovered some issues with this. They partnered with the Electronic Frontier Foundation to publicize it. And I don't say publicize in a dirty way, but they had a branded name for the vulnerabilities, eFail. And they announced it, or announced that they had this research coming. There were some problems with it, which we'll get into later in the disclosure process. But there have been a lot of heated debates, a lot of Twitter feuds, a lot of back and forth between different open source organizations, vendors, security researchers. There's just been a lot of, I don't want to say ill will, because I don't think that's it, but a lot of frustration, a lot of differing opinions, a lot of heated arguments about this. It's been fascinating. We've had arguments ourselves over Slack about this. I came out of the gate on Monday very hot about some things that went on, and lo and behold, later my position sort of slowly changed on a number of fronts because of new information, which we'll get into later. But Peter, eFail, the vulnerabilities, you know encryption. You have written books about some of this stuff. Do you want to sort of quickly explain what is going on?
Sure.
Deep breath.
So, I mean, I just saw this morning for the first time the actual academic paper on this attack, on the eFail attack. And it's 20 pages, 26 pages long.
Yeah.
No, sorry. I don't know. It's over 20 pages.
It's over.
Long.
Yeah, it's long.
It's longish.
Yeah.
The approach that I take with a lot of technical things is I try to figure out what it all means, and then if I can encapsulate it and sort of summarize it, I sort of use that as a shorthand, because the bottom line is what these researchers found was that clients that are doing encryption and decryption of PGP, rather than implementing a feature that was recommended to be implemented in all clients about 10 years ago, a lot of clients were not implementing that.
Mm.
And the result is, and it was a reasonably among the, you know, the community, a reasonably well-known and understood flaw.
Yeah.
Basically, rather than specifying going forward, clients must not implement PGP without implementing this protection, the PGP control, the people who are in charge of PGP rather said they should, clients should implement this feature to remediate the vulnerability that was discovered 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The result being, and this is, you know, must versus should is kind of, you would think that a should would always be implemented. And we've had lots of experience with TCP/IP and related protocols, everything that's been done by IETF. And to me, I mean, the difference between must and should comes across a lot when you're looking at internet protocols.
Yep.
Here we have an encryption protocol where it's even more important to get things right. And the implementers were looking at it or not looking at it or whatever they were doing, but they didn't. As many of the implementations of PGP, which as much as people like to say that that's one of the most influential encryption programs around, it's also one of the most complicated and kind of hard to use.
Mm.
If you're using it, unless you're using it at the command line, in which case it's confusing and hard to use, but at least you know you can sort of keep track of what you're doing if you're doing it at a command line. If you're using a graphical user interface for PGP, then you have to, you're not only depending on the PGP implementation of the actual, you know, doing the encryption, doing the decryption, and that being correct, you also have to rely on the people who've encoded the GUI that's running PGP, that they also have gotten it all correct. And that's not always a done deal. You can't always trust that that's the case.
Right.
And in fact, the last time that I wrote about PGP is a book back came out in about 5 years ago, 2013, called Simple Steps to Data Encryption. Mm. And I specifically did not even list, I if I remember correctly, I didn't even list the different options that you could have for doing GUI implementations of PGP, because there was none, there was no implementation that seemed to be a market leader, that was being regularly updated, that was that had a reputation as being trustworthy and worth using. I said, look, you know, if you want to understand how to use this, do it at the command line and you'll see everything happening. So that's the that's my take on it. PGP is not widely used, but S/MIME is widely
used.
And they depend on a lot of the same functions and a lot of the same code, and that is also integrated into clients all over the place. So
the issue with S/MIME is different than the PGP issue. I mean, not different in the I think you had mentioned that S/MIME, and a lot of other people have said this, the PGP stuff is sort of overshadowing the S/MIME stuff. S/MIME is in real trouble.
Right.
There's my technical evaluation.
Yeah. So the bottom line is that we've discovered that things are not always done on a comprehensive and systematic way when people are implementing, when people are designing. For all intents and purposes, I'd call this a protocol rather than an application, because there are very specific ways that you have to implement PGP.
Right.
And it is implemented multiple times, which is, theoretically, it's a good thing, because you want the best implementation to sort of float up to the top and the bad ones to sink to the bottom. But again, not really widely used, so there's an uptake problem with that. And on the other hand, the people that are using it are probably using it because they really, really need to be able to be safe.
Yeah. How many journalists have PGP keys? I mean, I know Michael Heller, our own security reporter here at Search Security. A lot of people do it. A lot of people use Signal as well, but. And the reason we should say all of this matters is because, according to the researchers and now the experts that have reviewed the paper, the vulnerabilities, so let's say these clients don't implement PGP correctly, it essentially allows attackers to come in and obtain the plain text version of the encrypted messages, which is like the worst case scenario. Like, if you're using encryption, you're like, I've got to send this email. You're like on the campaign trail, and you're like, I've got to send this email for about this, you know, illicit payment or this scandal or whatever, you know, is going on behind the scenes. And it turns out that somebody can just waltz in and take the plain text.
Not good.
That's pretty bad.
Pretty bad.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah.
It's a serious issue, obviously, because, like I said, it's the worst case scenario. To your point about PGP not being widely used, it's true. I mean, it's not as widely used as it used to be, but there was a lot of sort of back and forth, like I said, about these vulnerabilities in the research. And a debate popped up about early on, the discussion was about, well, whose fault is this? If it's the developers who are building these clients and they see a warning that says, oh, if you do this, X will happen, and they don't do it, isn't it on the developers, the people who build the clients? And then the opposite argument is, well, why even make it an option if you know how bad it is if they do this?
So the question is, do we blame the developers of the clients, or do we blame the developers of the PGP? And as I mentioned, I'll call it a protocol. And my reaction is, well, why not both? Because on the protocol side, if you specify the protocol, the specifications don't always take into account. They don't always repeat or summarize even the debates that have gone on behind, especially behind things that are a little controversial or that have caused a lot of back and forth. They'll just say you should implement modification detection codes, which is the thing that everybody should have done in their clients. They don't necessarily say because otherwise people will be able to decrypt your data.
Yeah.
If they did put that into the protocol specification, maybe it would have made a difference. But again, should versus must is a very big difference. And you'd think, so that's on one side. On the developer side, you'd think that they would understand that if it says should, it's probably a really good idea to do it.
Right.
Especially since that's one of the ways that you're doing authentication, which is part of the an integrity protection, which is specifically what you're doing when you're using PGP.
Yeah.
That's what you're trying to get done.
Right. I think initially I was on the side of, well, this is more of a development issue, right? And then I kind of went the other way with it because, I mean, obviously you want the developers that are using your protocol to use it correctly, and if you say you should do this, you expect people, you know, you hope that people are out there, they're paying attention to detail, they're familiar with the tech, they're going to do that. On the other hand, these guys know better than anybody else how many different organizations use open source software, open source protocols, and I feel like they should probably have known better. Like they probably should have said, well, there's a chance that a significant number of people are just going to run right through this roadblock, which isn't even really a roadblock. It's just kind of a blinking light that's warning you about a dangerous intersection. So instead of like them putting up a roadblock and saying, take another route, this one's going to end badly, they're saying, watch out, danger. You can go through if you want. You know, we're warning you. And I know I brought up the Amazon thing, right? Amazon, AWS, S3 buckets. We talked about this offline.
Mm-hmm.
But to reiterate and to let the listeners in on what we were discussing, you know, I kind of compared this early on to the S3 buckets. It's like, what is the responsibility of Amazon if they know that this many companies are out there sort of accidentally exposing their S3 buckets, making them publicly available without any access controls? Do you need to say, like, to your point, do you need to say attackers are going to read your data if you don't if you do what you're about to do? Do they have to spell it out that way? Does Amazon have to say, if you put this up right now without any access control, anybody can read it? Like, do they have to spell it out that way? Or is this, you know, also on the companies that are doing it, that are using it?
Well, I mean, one big difference between the AWS S3 bucket situation and this situation is that when you're a customer of AWS and you've got an S3 bucket, you're the client, you're the one in control, you have that option.
Yes.
When you're using a piece of software that your company, let's say, has acquired for you, and the implementers were not forced to do the should rather than, you know, making it a must, they haven't implemented it correctly, you as the end user don't really have a choice, and the implementers may not even be aware of the importance of doing it. One thing that I'm reminded of in the early conversations about this, points that was raised was that back then, when the modification detection codes were suggested as being important to implement, part of the reason, or one of the justifications that came up, was that the PGP community was not inclined to make it a must because they felt that the client implementers, the implementation side, were not really all caught up, and that they weren't quite there yet.
And it was forcing something on them that was just too early. And
And I mean, you got to also remember that PGP has been around for a long time. I want to say about 20 years or so, maybe more. And it's always got a good reputation as being strong and secure and encryption and all of this stuff, but it's never really caught on in a big way as far as an end user application. So there's always been this kind of, I think that people who are writing protocol specifications or designing things like this that are supposed to be implemented by others have to skate a fine line because they don't want to make it so hard to implement that nobody implements it.
Yeah.
At the same time, they, you know, if they do that, they risk having it no longer be useful.
Well, it's worth noting to you know, before we move on to the next section, you know, it seems like a lot of people, once they got a look at the research, a lot of the people that are familiar with PGP and encryption have sort of come down on more on the side that, this is something that the PGP guys should have done earlier on. And Matthew Green, cryptography expert, computer science professor at Johns Hopkins, he wrote on this extensive blog on eFail, a blog post. I encourage people to read it. It was really good. He wrote, quote, "This is probably the most unfortunate part of the eFail story because in this case, Privacy Guard, is very much at fault. Their API does something that directly violates cryptographic best practices, namely releasing unauthenticated plain text prior to producing an error message. So even though the error message is produced, it's still not, there's still problems there. So, you know, food for thought. But now I want to turn to, and we've mentioned it at the top, but the disclosure process here, it was not smooth. And we actually had internal debates on how to term the sort of the level of tumult or chaos that maybe went on here. And initially I thought it was pretty bad, but not like a complete train wreck because, well, they did get the research was done. They got it out quickly. It wasn't, you know, a case where something gets leaked early and attackers start exploiting it and, you know, everybody has egg on their face. But basically what happened was on Sunday, Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, they put out a post saying this research is coming. Sebastian Schinzel, who is a computer science professor at, I believe it's Munster University in Germany, one of the researchers involved in the project, also tweeted about this, sort of previewed it on Sunday and said, there are major issues. This is bad. You should think about uninstalling or not using, like temporarily disabling or uninstalling this stuff. The research is coming out on Tuesday. Well, that led to a lot of people saying, what's happening? What's going on? They start speculating on Twitter. Twitter was a flutter with this stuff. You know, the GNUPG guys start saying, well, this is what's going on, we think. And, you know, Schinzel comes in and says, you know, please stop talking about this until the embargo is up and the research is out. Not the greatest look. On Monday, the paper, someone finds that the paper is online already. So Schinzel and the researchers just turn around and say, well, we're going to put it out now because the embargo has been broken. Well, the embargo was broken, yes, but it's not like somebody – I know there was someone actually did leak some information on I think a forum, but it wasn't or a bug report or something, but it wasn't the full extent. So the people were already kind of talking about this, but I mean, you know me, like teasing a vulnerability like that, even if it's just a mere 48 hours ahead of time, I don't really like that. I think that that's, you get what you get when you do that.
Yeah, I mean, and I may be overly a stickler on this point, but to me, an embargo is an agreement between a source and a journalist or a news outlet, in which the source gives information to the news outlet ahead of the announcement. It's pretty time-honored kind of tradition.
And you don't publish.
And you don't publish before. Now,
anything. Not even like, I got a big story.
Right. Right.
I know, well, people try to get around that.
Yeah. But the point is that when you say that there's an embargo, my initial reaction was, well, I never got offered that as a journalist. Nobody called me up and said, hey, we have a story under embargo. So I'm not sure that the term is being used correctly here.
I think they mean like with telling the other organizations, the vendors involved. But yeah, I don't know that any media, EFF's not really a media organization.
No, they're a non-NGO. Right. But so to me, though, this is a classic case of where coordinated vulnerability disclosure would have worked, been a good idea, where everybody who gets the information has to agree ahead of time that this is how we're going to this is how we're going to proceed, and that means that they should have contacted and been in touch with all of the implementers, the implementations that they found. Now, we found out afterwards that the, GNU Privacy Guard people were notified, and they kind of said, well, we're not considering this a vulnerability.
Werner Koch of the organization. Yeah, they said they weren't contacted, and then I think Schinzel was the person who did this, who basically said, I did, and here, I got receipts.
Yes.
You know, as the saying goes, the emails I sent you, and here are the dates. And then he posted later on in the week, this week, saying, oh, I got these, but I forgot.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's okay if you're like the 12th biggest implementer of a protocol that's not widely implemented by a lot of mass products. But when people think about PGP, the implementation that most people default to is GPG, GNU Privacy Guard.
Yeah.
Because that's the one that's really the one that's been around for the longest and that has the biggest community of developers. So that's the one that people are going to be using. Now, if I'm the guy who discovered, the person who discovered the vulnerability, I'm going to want to make sure that that is the one organization that I have cooperation with. And if they ignore me the first time around, I'm just going to keep hammering them and try to get other people to notify them.
Yeah.
But you have to get the whole community behind, or everybody involved behind it, and ready to ship their patches.
Yeah.
Ahead of the announcement, because otherwise, I mean, the paper, I was starting, as I was reading the paper, they talked about how here's our proof of concept, but it's not the only one, and others could follow, and now that the paper is out, attackers are almost certainly going to be looking into how they can weaponize the vulnerability.
Right, and how, I mean, if people didn't clue in, you know, developers didn't clue on into this, you know, years before, are we definitely sure they're going to do it now? Which, you know, that brings me to sort of the final point. Does it matter that the disclosure process was not smooth? Does it matter? Like, we already said, as far as we know, and it is hard to detect whether or not this has been exploited, but there's been no indication that anyone's, you know, used it, that it's being actively exploited in the wild. There's none of that sort of tumult or chaos that was caused by the paper leaking earlier, people speculating about it Sunday, Monday, about the tease that happened on Sunday. So does it matter? And what are your thoughts?
Well,
is this sort of, I mean, because a lot of people, I mean, Matthew Green being one of them, said, you know, so what went wrong? Very little. This is, you know, this is what happens with disclosure process. You, like you said, coordinated disclosure is very hard. Mike has written stories about this. We've talked to a lot of people. There's a lot of moving parts. So does it matter that something like this has been in the works since like January? And
I thought it was even last year.
Oh, no, yeah, that's right. I think when they contacted some organizations in January, but they had been, yeah, it goes back even further, yeah.
Well, I mean, we see this kind of, you know, I don't want to call it botched or even bungled, but kind of when you have large groups of people that are sharing a secret and you're all supposed to be coordinated on it, it's not easy, especially when there are people that are doing these, you know, it's an open source
spare time.
Yeah, it's
for their love of the code.
Exactly. So they're, yeah. I mean, they're doing it out of the goodness of their hearts, and everybody's got their own reasons for doing these things.
Right.
Everybody's got their own incentives, and those incentives don't always match up or don't always mesh. So at the end of the day, though, we learned about. We got the teaser on Sunday, and then we got the details on Monday and Tuesday. And I think ultimately, yeah, maybe there was some exposures. Maybe there will be some exposures. Maybe we'll find out that somebody exploited it. But
all in all, not bad.
All in all, not bad. And also, some of the experts that I have followed on Twitter indicated that. Yeah, this is not like a totally simple, obvious flaw, and it doesn't. You can't make it work every single time. It might be, you know, some fraction of the times that you attempt it. It's not a trivial thing, is the point.
So sure.
If it were trivial,
then it'd be easy.
And the embargo, so called, was broken a week or a month in advance, or you know. You can think of a lot of scenarios that would have been a lot worse. But, yeah, bottom line, long term, you know, I'm going to guess that everybody's going to try to fix their client implementations and their GUI implementations. And at the end of the day, it's still, you know, PGP is not the most widely used form of encryption.
Right, but it is used by a lot of people in our profession.
This is true.
So, yeah. I'll go slightly the other way on this. I think Green makes some good points. I think you've made some good points on why we shouldn't obsess too much about, you know, the bumps in the road on this one. And I'll go the other way and just say, yes, it's not as if there was some type of like catastrophic foul up here with the way this was handled and that it had a tangible effect on the remediation efforts or handling the vulnerabilities or getting the word out, because I don't think it did. But I will say that I think when things like this go down the way that they do, I do worry about long-term effects. Like, I worry about other researchers out there saying, well, these guys had found something really good and, you know, the GNUPG. So you say GNU Privacy Guard.
Correct.
I say GNUPG.
I know.
Is that wrong? You've written books. I've heard it both ways. Is this going to be like a GIF thing? Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know. I can't specifically give you an authoritative answer on GNU Privacy Guard, but GNU, having spent a small amount of time with the Free Software Foundation here and there, they pronounce it GNU.
GNU.
And
GNU. So if I wanted to say GNU PG, that would be the way to do it, not GNU PG?
Well, that's what...
We got to go to YouTube after this and figure out...
I say GNU PG or GNU Privacy Guard or GPG is the other one that's easier.
Okay. Well, in any case, like if you're a researcher and you see these open source guys saying, not our problem, or we don't think this is a vulnerability, it's a little discouraging. When you see, you know, and on the other side, like when you see the researchers teasing this ahead of time, and like, I don't want to say like they caused hysteria, because they didn't. And if you read like what the EFF said, it said temporarily disable or, uninstall this stuff until you can figure out what's wrong. But there was a lot of reactions in the industry. Like a lot of people were saying, this is ridiculous. The EFF is wrong. They shouldn't be saying this. I mean, what was it? One of the vendors, and I don't remember, Proton Mail was saying, and Matt Green called this out, was saying this is wrong what the EFF is doing. The recommendations to disable these, you know, PGP plugins could put lives at risk, like quote unquote, put lives at risk. So when you see that sort of stuff happening for whatever reason, like it's not a great look for the security industry. It's not a great look. It doesn't exactly scream, yes, I want to go into vulnerability hunting. I want to go into bug hunting. I want to go into security research. I want to go into security research around open source protocols and encryption and things like that, like community-based software. Like, that's not a great sign. And, like, if it can be handled better, just like, 10% better, I think that goes a long way to sending a better message to not just the people externally, like enterprise people, people in the media like us, but the people that are in the industry saying, well, I want to do research. I want to find bugs and I want to report them to the right people. Even if they don't have bug bounties, this is important for the entire technology industry, the entire collective out there. And if we don't handle it better, I do worry that more people are just going to be like, this isn't worth it. I'll just sell it to the NSA or I'll put it up on the dark web. Or, you know, if people aren't going to appreciate this, or if they're not going to respond to it the right way, or if we're not going to find a balanced way to present it, then what's the point? So that's me. And I take the pessimistic view, and I know that. You take the optimistic view, and God bless you, Peter. So thank you for balancing, you know, my pessimism on this one. But
you're welcome.
But this was a fascinating topic to discuss. Oh, yeah. I mean, we knew going into this one that there was a lot going on, a lot of moving parts with this. And there may be more moving parts. I know we've done a couple articles on this already. I should say Mike Heller has done a couple articles. But there may be more information to come as this sort of goes along. So thank you, Peter, for joining me on this one and helping me out and dropping knowledge about crypto and, you know, the books that you've written. So thank you.
Always glad to be here.
And thank you to the readers and listeners of Search Security. I'm Rob Wright, and we will see you next time.